Join my friends, Jeremy and Kelly, with their combined background in DNA, journalism, and law, as they share tales of injustice and intrigue with a focus on true crimes along the banks of the Mississippi. So sit back, grab a glass of sweet tea, and welcome to Riverside Homicide.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Riverside Homicide. I'm Jeremy.
And I'm Kelly.
How was your day today?
It was all right. It's a Monday, so...
Rainy.
Know. Yeah, about to be...
Sets the mood for the case we're about to cover.
Yeah, kind of gloomy, kind of terrible. It's a Monday kind of case. I can see that. You may also, just a forewarning, we said this in the last podcast, you may hear some background noise in this one.
Your puppies want to be involved.
They are very, very clingy and very needy, and they want to be in the podcast really bad. So you may hear them. And
what are your dogs' names? Let's let everybody know.
Oh, my dogs' names are Lily and Penny, and they're adorable, and I love them very much, but they're being very annoying right now. So
they're like 6 inches away from you right now. And this is our like 8th time trying to start this episode. So we're just going to continue on.
We're just going to power
barks
through.
And scratches and all.
So just enjoy the ride. That may be part of it, but it'll be okay.
All right, let's get to it.
So the case today is a local one. It's the murder of 39-year-old Jennifer Jackson that happened in 2005. I have zero memory of this case. Do you remember it when it happened?
I do not. I was it 2005? I would have been almost 30. I was traveling around the world and...
I had just graduated from high school, and I feel like I should remember this because...
It was probably on the local news, but I really wasn't watching the news.
I guess we weren't. I guess we were busy in 2005.
I was watching Survivor. Amazing
Important
days.
Things.
Yes. Trash TV.
It is a unique case, though, because it's a matricide, which is rare, and the main suspect was the victim's 18-year-old daughter. I did a little research on matricides, and they are super rare. It says that less than 1% of all homicides involve the killing of a mother by her offspring, and less than 15% of those are girls 19 or younger. So it's incredibly rare. So I feel like I should have remembered this because I was the same age as the suspect. But yeah, so it's an interesting one. But why don't you go ahead and give us a little bit of background on our victim, on Jennifer?
So, like you mentioned, at the time of her death, she was 39 years old. Her friends described her as being, very well liked, being a fair person, caring, generous, positive, upbeat. So she was, very well liked amongst her friends. She was born in Savannah, Georgia in 1965. She came from a broken home. Her parents had divorced. Her mother, unfortunately, was an alcoholic who had abandoned all the kids and... left her husband. So Jennifer, our victim here, ended up getting kind of shuffled around. Her mother remarried. The kids didn't want to live with stepdad, so they relocated to Memphis, Tennessee, where they lived with their aunt and uncle. This is when Jennifer was about 15 years old. So, time period in your life that's a lot of changes going on anyway, and here her family's kind of unstable,
right?
But she relocated to Memphis, and she actually made a lot of strides in bettering herself. She went through high school in just 3 years. She went to college, finished in 3 years, so she's pretty much independent, taking care of herself by the age of 17.
She sounded like a very self-sufficient person. Around the time that she was in college, things get even more interesting for her. It's while she's attending Memphis State. It used to be called Memphis State. It's University of Memphis now. She met the father of her child. His name was Nazmi. He was also a student there at the time. Nazmi was 4 years older than Jennifer. He was a shorter man. I think he was actually shorter than her, only 5'5". He was Lebanese, and people described him as the life of the party. He was just...
Big personality.
Big personality. Quickly in their relationship, they became pregnant with their daughter, Nora, and they got married on December 13th, 1986 in Memphis. Nora was born 3 months later on St. Patrick's Day in 1987.
You guys are close in age.
Yeah.
But that marriage, it had a lot of problems.
Right from the get-go.
Yeah, they ended up divorcing like 6 months later in September of 87. They still stayed in each other's lives, I guess because of Nora.
Right.
Occasionally they would... end up staying together, living together briefly, even after the divorce. But eventually, their relationship just got to the point where police got involved. Jennifer called the police and told them that he was beating on her, threatening to kill her and the baby. Not sure how often this happened, but there was at least one time that the police were involved. After this divorce ended, she was granted full custody of Nora in 1992, and she changed Nora's name to Nora Grace Jackson. That's a Jackson.
Sean Connery.
Yes, I'm Sean Connery.
So she changed her name back to her...
Her maiden name, Jackson, and then she replaced Nora's middle name, which used to be associated to her biological father.
Yeah, so she was trying to cut all ties.
Yeah, she just kind of erased him out of her life. So they continued to fight, unfortunately, the parents did, over child custody and child support throughout the next couple years.
And I think for many of those years, he was not really involved with Nora's life at all. It was just a very distant relationship. At the age of 27, Jennifer remarried. This is another unhappy marriage to a man named Jimmy Harris Jr. He was a farmer in Arkansas. The marriage was just fraught with all sorts of problems. Instances of Jimmy gambling and cheating. He admitted to giving Jennifer an STD. And their divorce records show that Jimmy assaulted Jennifer in front of Nora, which is awful. So that means at a very, very young age, Nora was exposed to violence. Close to her, in her household. Jennifer separated from Jimmy at the age of 30. And in that brief time where they were, while she was married to him, she and Nora moved 6 times in 3 years. So they were just shuffling back and forth.
Not very stable.
Yeah, not super stable.
even though she was still legally married to Jimmy, she and Nora moved to Atlanta, Georgia. And she went to work for MCI, which the telephone company,
Does MCI still exist?
I don't think so.
Okay.
And in 2001, her divorce finally came through and she changed her name, Jennifer did, back to her maiden name. So she went back to Jennifer Jackson. And at this time, she was working as an insurance agent for Allstate. And she began her career in investment banking. And that's what she was doing up until the time of her death. She was back in 2005, yeah. She was working as a bond trader for SunTrust. Here in Memphis.
Okay. She was pictures of her. She was a beautiful woman, tall, blonde, athletic. I think they said she was a triathlete even. She was also apparently a shopaholic, a little bit of a hoarder. Like, we saw pictures of her home. And
Definitely looked like a episode of Hoarders.
Yeah, but not like the dirty kind, like the kind where you obsessively buy stuff.
Lots of clutter. Unorganized.
But apparently, as I said, she was working as a bond trader. She did own her home in Memphis outright. So she must have been at least financially successful to own her home and to have the ability to do all that shopping.
So let's talk a little bit about her ex-husband and Nora's father, Nazmi. Because unfortunately, this story or this case is riddled with multiple unsolved murders. About a year and a half before Jennifer was murdered, her ex-husband, Nazmi, was also murdered in the convenience store that he owned. It was called Nora's Quick Stop in Memphis. It wasn't in the best of areas. It was near Platinum Plus Strip Club, which I don't believe exists anymore.
I don't think it's still around. I don't know. But any locals would know that's not like the greatest area.
Right. And this happened in January of 2004. He was 43 at the time, and his murder didn't seem like an ordinary murder. It was even a robbery at that, because the video surveillance tape shows him coming out from behind the counter to greet the guy who shot him. The killer ransacks the store like he's looking for something. Eventually, he takes the security tape, I guess believing that there was only one copy, but there turned out to be a backup.
Right. So if it wasn't a regular robbery, then what was it? So there's several theories about that. Some people think that Nazmi had shady dealings with the Mexican cartel.
So Memphis has a lot of gang activity.
Right.
So... That's interesting.
Yeah, and it's, in fact, the day that he was shot, it was the day before he was scheduled to testify in federal court against cartel members. So did one of them shoot him to keep him silent? I don't know. Hmm. Another interesting thing about Nazmi is he owned a private limousine company, and there were rumors that he had dealings with some sex workers. Mind you, he did work down the road from the strip club, so I don't know if that's involved or not. But there was rumors of videotapes that he would film things that were going on in his car. So there was an episode, I think that 48 Hours and 2020, I think they both did an episode about this case. And I was watching it, and on one of them, one of the police officers that was interviewed said that Nazmi would have been arrested if they'd known about some of the things that he was up to. And this particular police officer said that he thought that other police officers were involved in some of this bad behavior with the limousines and the videotape. He had a theory that maybe one of the police officers knew something about Nazmi.
Didn't want to be exposed.
Yeah, so I don't know. Maybe it was he had high profile people in his limousines that didn't want things, like you said, exposed about their activities. I don't know. Was he killed because of that? Was he killed because of the cartel? Was it just none of those? And was it a totally random robbery? We don't know. The police,
it's still unsolved.
It's unsolved. The police were never able to determine who killed him. This is all important, though, because Jennifer, his ex-wife, she's the one who, she got all of his belongings after his death, which later led to speculation that perhaps the two murders were somehow connected, but we can get into that theory later.
So as you mentioned, Nazmi and his daughter Nora, they hadn't, grown up together. Right. She hadn't grown up with him as a father figure, but they had recently, just in the past 2 years or so, reconnected. Most of her life, he wasn't around. So, his death, no doubt, impacted her. Mm-hmm. She had reconnected with him. She also lost a close friend of hers, I think.
Her name was Anna. I think it was a car accident. Yeah.
So, with the death of her father, the death of her friend, that took a toll on her. And she started kind of acting out as a result. She had a reputation of being a party girl, drinking, doing drugs, being promiscuous. By the time she was 18, she was still a junior in high school, and things just weren't looking good for her. She was constantly arguing with her mother. They were just battling each other at all times.
Yeah, about curfew, about drugs, about boys. She thought she was going to inherit a lot of money from her father's estate, so they were arguing about that. It was just a battle, it sounded like, all the time. In an interview I watched, Nora herself admitted that she was spoiled. Jennifer, as we said, was financially successful. She was a single parent, though, so she probably had a lot of guilt, I think, about some of her relationships, not having a father figure in Nora's life, moving around a lot. So it sounds like she was probably a little more lenient with Nora than maybe
she'll
have been.
Maybe she'll be her friend instead of her brother.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like. So anyway, they had a difficult relationship, but things were coming to a head, as you said. Around Memorial Weekend in 2005, this is roughly a week before the murder, Jennifer had plans to take Nora to Florida to visit some family there. And it just sounded like a nightmare trip that I was reading about. Jennifer had recently given Nora a drug test, which Nora failed.
Awkward.
Yeah, and they're talking about it on the road. Can you imagine being stuck in a car and be like, oh, I had to give you a drug test. You failed it. That's not going to be a good trip for anybody.
I mean, for Florida, if they were, I don't know what part they were going, but it's at least a 15-hour trip, depending on where you're going.
It's going to be rough. Jennifer was threatening to send Nora to military or boarding school, which I actually, now that I think about it, I don't really know how she would have been able to, since Nora was technically an adult at 18. But regardless of the fact, I think this concerned Nora that her mom was threatening her with this.
Just send her away somewhere, maybe.
Yeah. And Nora was not helping herself at all, because while they were away that weekend, she gave her friends permission to use her home to throw a giant party. Well, this is while they're in Florida.
Parties at her house.
Nora
while
and Jennifer's
house.
Yeah. So they've got all these teenagers drinking and whatnot, and gets out of hand. Neighbors call Jennifer. The police get called. Jennifer's super mad at Nora, which I would be too,
Mm-hmm.
And so it had to have been a really awkward trip, Nora's uncle, her half-uncle, his name was Eric, he was also on this road trip with them, and he said that on the way back home from Florida, the conversation took an interesting turn, because Jennifer took a work call, which was apparently pretty common for her, which led to Nora asking about her jobs, about bond trading, wanting to know more about it. And eventually that led to Nora questioning Jennifer about how much money she was worth. Jennifer's estate was apparently valued around $1.5 million. And Jennifer let Nora know that she was on her policies and she was going to inherit everything. Policies. Yeah. Now, mind you, this is just coming from one source, just from Eric. But it does come into play later on because prosecution's going to use this as a motive against Nora.
So that leads up to the murder, June 4th, 2005. Jennifer, the mother, decides that, you know, if Nora disobeyed her again, then something was going to have to change.
Right. She couldn't live with her anymore. Mm-hmm. It was done.
So that evening, Jennifer went to a wedding in downtown Memphis, and then she attended the wedding reception in East Memphis, which is close to kind of where they lived. She and her friend, his name was Jimmy, not her second husband, but just another
Jimmy.
Another Jimmy. They went together, and then after the reception, they went to a bar to have a drink. And this bar was Cockeyed Camel,
mm-hmm.
which is a place that I frequented a lot.
To do karaoke,
yes.
It was like a bar restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
But I was
food
like,
food was not great.
But no, yeah. I remember the food wasn't great. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think
Monday nights karaoke.
But apparently that was a place she liked to go a lot.
I could have met her. I never know.
Maybe. She may have been there when you were doing karaoke one night.
Mm-hmm. I went a lot.
Hmm.
Anyway, so they stop at this, Jennifer and her boyfriend or friend stop at this establishment to have a drink. Jen leaves around 11 o'clock at night and gets home around 11:30. This was the weekend of the Italian festival in Memphis. So like once a year, there's this...
they serve food. I mean, I wouldn't say it's a fair because, like, I don't know that they have big rides. But
they're celebrating the Italian heritage,
right?
So it's
with lots
crafts,
eat a lot,
food, and games,
mm-hmm,
and
the
like
money
that.
Goes to a charity or a church or something like that.
And it's,
I haven't gone, but I've
it's
seen
in East
it.
Memphis too. It's not too far from where they live.
Yeah.
So that Saturday morning, Nora had plans to hang out at a friend's house. She was going to be at the pool and, I guess, get involved with all the...
she was going to drink and do drugs. That was her plan.
That was her plan.
Yeah.
And
go to the Italian festival.
Mm-hmm, that night, she went to a party at another friend's house, and she got into an argument with a boy. His name was Perry, and she was mad at him because, he had brought a different girl to the party. She ends up slapping him, making a big scene.
Yeah.
She was asked to leave, and so she made her way back to the Italian fest.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, she was, you know, probably drunk. She had already had a bunch of alcohol. She had already done some drugs, and she was taking some pain meds, right?
Yeah, Lortab.
So around midnight, a little after midnight, she got a call from her mom. And Jennifer was mad because...
She's supposed to be grounded. She's supposed
right,
to be home.
We just had this road trip.
You failed the drug test.
You failed the drug test. Mm-hmm. You had given permission to your friends to have people come to our
Rager
house.
Rager at my house.
Yeah, so she was upset that, you know, while Jennifer was out going to this wedding reception, stopped to have a drink, thinking her daughter's at home, her daughter's, you know, out and about.
Right.
So she told her to come home immediately and that they were going to go to church the next morning.
Yeah. The timeline from here on out is a little bit convoluted. It's a little bit shaky. After the call from her mother, Nora said that she bought cigarettes at a gas station. She gave different statements, and they all kind of conflict with one another. According to one statement she gave, she drove by her own home. She said the lights were off, so she assumed her mother was asleep, and she didn't stop. So your theory, I like. Maybe she thought, oh, she's asleep. Like, I can stay out. She won't know if I'm not home. Like, that's an interesting theory. So maybe that's what it was. But as I said, her statement started to conflict. She says she drove around. She was high. She texted Perry. That was the guy that she slapped. She texted him at 1:13 in the morning. I want to get back together with you. I want to work on it. No response. He doesn't answer her. She's texting a lot that night. She also texts another friend of hers. His name is Andrew. She texts him on and off the whole evening. Andrew said that she asked him to meet her at her own home and to walk her inside, but he said no, he didn't go. Andrew also claimed he'd received a call from the Jacksons' landline, but that he didn't answer. Now, remember, she's saying, I'm not home. I'm out driving around. So why
he's
would
saying he got a call from
the
their
landline.
House.
Mm-hmm. I believe he also said that the last text he got from her was at 5 a.m. Sunday morning, June 5th. This text message that just says... answer. And then he gets a call, voicemail that says, I need to talk to you. And so this is 5 a.m., June 5th, and this is when things really start to go crazy for Nora.
And before we get into that, let's talk about her phone.
Her phone is crazy.
There's no cell phone activity for about 2 hours between 1:13 in the morning and 3:18 in the morning, which apparently was odd for Nora because she lived on her phone. I mean, most of us, we'd probably be asleep.
Yeah. But I guess it was unusual for her. Everybody said it was unusual for her. So she must have slept all day.
She's 18.
Yeah. She must have slept all day and stayed up all night.
So, you know, the getting that phone call from the landline's interesting. That call was apparently just around 1 o'clock in the morning when Nora claims she wasn't home. But then Nora called that same number again 10 minutes later from her cell phone at around 1:10 in the morning and left a voicemail. So does that mean she was at home?
And then
and she's like, oh, I shouldn't be calling from the house because, you know, phone records will show I'm home. Or maybe it was her mom calling Andrew saying, hey, do you know where my kid is? We don't know.
But I don't know. I get everything that I've read doesn't sound like her mom was close to Andrew or knew Andrew at all. So I don't even know that she would have his number. So, right. It's suspicious. Mm-hmm. It's weird that landline phone call. Andrew testified that Nora told him, I'm at home. And he claims that she asked him to meet her there, to walk her inside the house. And he thought that was super strange. It was a request that she'd never made before. And this comes into play later on.
So by 3:18 in the morning, Nora started using her phone again to call a friend, this time another person, another guy named Eric. She wanted to come over his house and hang out.
Who wants to go hang out
at 3 in the
somebody's
morning?
House at 3 in the morning?
Hey.
I would be so salty. No.
I had a friend growing up that would show up around 10 o'clock at night, and I'd be so irritated.
Yeah, but
what are you doing here?
But apparently these kids are all just awake because he said she could come over.
Come on over. So he said, come on over. But she got there, and he was leaving. He was going somewhere else. And that she was like, well, I don't want to go with you. So she chatted for 2-3 minutes and then left.
It's so weird.
She's out and about.
I don't understand any of this. The late night, just roaming around, doing nothing. Around 4:01 a.m., I don't know how to explain this. Things get interesting with Nora because there's footage of her going to a Walgreens to purchase first aid supplies for a cut that she had on the back of her hand. And this cut is a big deal later on. So remember that. This is around 4 in the morning.
All right. So the neighbors, Joe and Rachel, they claim around 5 o'clock in the morning they heard Nora screaming at their door. She told them that someone had broken into their house. So Joe, the neighbor, got his gun and he followed Nora back to the house. He thought it was odd because she didn't let him go in first. She took the lead. She went in first. So kind of odd if you...
Yeah, you know, if you're a girl.
Someone's broken into my house. You're an 18-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. Someone's broken our house and then you...
I mean, charge in.
Yeah. So he asks her, like, where's your mom? She says, oh, she's in the bedroom. So he walks in and he finds just a bloody mess. Her mother was, you know, clearly dead. She was not clothed. There was blood everywhere. So he runs back home, tells his wife to call 911. Meanwhile, Nora is calling 911 from the landline, and we're going to play that for you now.
Okay.
It probably won't be the greatest sound quality, but
we're doing the best we can.
Oh, 911.
Please, I need an ambulance. I need an ambulance right now.
If it's on the line, don't hang up.
Fire department, what's the address of your emergency?
5001 New Haven Avenue.
What's the problem, sir, exactly?
Nobody's broken my house. My mom is hurt. My mom is bleeding.
Is she breathing?
No, she's not breathing. She's not breathing. She's not breathing. Please help me.
Ma'am, was anyone shot?
So I don't know how well you guys could hear that, but I thought it sounded kind of believable, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's you could tell she's in distress, mm-hmm. or at least is putting on. That
I mean, she sounds upset.
Yeah, I would think finding or seeing, even if. it's your mother.
Right.
Either way, if you're the one who caused it or not, you're going to feel some sort of way.
I think it sounds more believable than you think it sounds believable.
Yeah, well.
You think she's faking it in that call?
I don't know. Just, if you're not in that position, it's hard, you know.
Yeah,
who's
it's hard
to say? Who's to say? I'm not going to say one way or the other. I don't know. The thing that's some people find odd is that the dispatcher asked her, you know, have your mother been shot? And she said no. The prosecution will go on later to question this because they wonder, oh, how does she know if she had been shot or stabbed? You know, I think in that call she said there's just blood everywhere. Right. There's blood everywhere. Now, could she have misheard the 911 operator or, you know, what have you? I don't know. But some people say, you know, well, she was quick to say no, she hadn't been shot. So some people say, well, how would she know that unless she's the one who did it?
Right.
There was no evidence that her mom had been sexually assaulted. You know, mind you, she was, nude. The coroner did say, though, that Jennifer had been stabbed more than 50 times. And that's significant.
Like, right. That's rage.
That's personal.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was also this aspect of a wicker basket that
right.
was placed on Jennifer's head. Now, you were telling me that there were some conflicting stories about
right.
that.
Because Nora says there was a basket on her head when she found her mother. But then the neighbors say, they swear up and down, oh, there wasn't a basket on her head. Because I think the woman, I believe her name was Rachel, what's the word? The 911 operator was trying to convince Rachel to do CPR. And she said that she was looking in Jennifer's eyes. And she was like, no, she's gone. So she mentions no wicker basket. But then when the first responders come, the first responder's like, yeah, and I took the basket off of her head. So
the basket there was the basket on and off of
why is it getting moved?
Head. Right. I mean, you would think that it's being covered because of
Don't want to look at her.
Mm-hmm. Guilt. Just I don't think
a stranger would do that. No. I think it would be, I can't stand looking at you, so I have to cover you up.
But could it be, you know, you walk in and you see it and you're like, oh, this is awful. I don't want to remember my mother this way.
Yeah.
Or
I don't know.
Or was there something, you know, was the basket put on her face, you know, during the crime?
Right.
You know, just weird. But police said they took that to mean that the killer was someone close to her.
Right.
So the 50 stab wounds alone shows to me that it's personal.
Right. Well, stabbing.
There's nothing, because there was no robbery here.
Right. Nothing was stolen.
I mean, she said someone broke into my house.
Right.
And we'll talk about that in a little bit.
I mean, how could you tell in that house that anything would have even been missing? There was so much stuff in there. There's nothing that they've reported that was missing. Other evidence that the police found that indicated that the killer knew Jennifer, this is interesting, was broken glass that was found from a door between the kitchen and the garage. Now, everything I've read and watched, I don't know if I just overlooked it. I can't tell if the garage was open or not. But what's interesting about this door was it had it was a three-panel door with horizontal windows. It had three little windows. And it was the middle window that was broken, not the bottom one. You'd think if you're trying to break into a house,
get the doorknob.
Yeah, you'd break into the one closest to the doorknob at the bottom. Well, this one, the middle was broken. And what's unusual about this door is that it had a second hidden lock on the inside of the house right by the middle pane window. And you wouldn't see it from the outside. You'd only know about that lock if you knew about it from the inside of the house. So the police were thinking, well, someone had to have known about this lock to have broken that particular window pane.
So, you know, people start wondering, well, who's involved?
They start guessing immediately.
Start guessing.
Which, so, I mean, that's
right.
Normal.
So one of Jennifer's friends, his name was Ansley.
I think it's a woman.
Oh, well, her name was Ansley. Sorry. Immediately started to think that it was Jennifer's on and off again boyfriend.
His name was Mark.
Mark. He was a Methodist pastor. So he had called Jennifer the night of the murder. Apparently, they kind of had an up and down relationship, you know, kind of par for the course with her. Police looked into him and mentioned that he took a very active interest in the case. Now, to them, this meant that he was either genuinely interested and concerned, or perhaps he just wanted to know what the police knew because he was involved. His alibi was that he was asleep at the time of the murder, so he wasn't out running around. He's claiming he wasn't, you know, partying
it up
like everybody else was that night. But mind you, he lived in Jackson, Tennessee. Jackson, Tennessee is like 90 minutes, hour and a half away from Memphis. So he's saying, I was at home alone, asleep.
How can you prove or disprove that?
Right.
By yourself.
Yeah, I don't make a log every time I go to sleep.
No, it's not a great alibi.
But what do you do? So either way, police didn't really find any evidence that connected him to the crime. They just moved on. But they started honing in on Nora, Jennifer's daughter.
Mark mentioned that he called her and he realized how late it was and then he hung up immediately and he didn't leave a voice message. So I do think it'd been interesting. What did he want to talk to her about? Because they were broken up at this time. What he wanted to call about. Was he wanting to get back together? And what if she had answered? Like, maybe things would have been different somehow if she had answered the phone. I don't know. It's just, what if?
And did he call from his cell phone?
I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know which phone he called from. But I did think that was interesting.
Did they do a good job checking his alibi?
I don't think they did a great job with
any of
it. Well,
as with a lot of the cases we covered, we come across some not so great police work sometimes. Right. So there is, even in this trial that we'll talk about in a minute, there's some gaps.
Yeah. So pretty much, as you said, the police begin to suspect Nora right away. The police only had circumstantial evidence against her, but they viewed that as enough. So on September 29th, 2005, 3 months into the investigation, she was charged with second-degree murder.
Now, what happened after?
In between? I was reading about the account of, you know, just the brief few months between, you know, the death of her mother and getting arrested. And it sounded like Nora was just living it up. Like, her aunts put her in an apartment, a nice apartment, that she only was able to live in for a month because she quickly got evicted because she was having loud parties and she'd got a Rottweiler dog that she wasn't supposed to. And then she started just couch surfing amongst friends and she didn't live with any family. It just sounded like she was having a carefree time. She was partying with her friends. She got back together with Perry, the guy that she slapped.
Casey Anthony.
Yes, that's what I thought. I will say people handle grief differently. Some people, you know, fall apart and are sad, and other people try to distract themselves. So I don't know if that's what she was doing, if she's trying to distract herself, or if genuinely it's just her aunts, her family viewed it as, I don't care, I'm not upset. So that's the way it came across to some people.
Well, so the prosecutor, she asked for a life sentence.
Right.
But
she asked for a very high bond, $500,000. Nora couldn't pay it. So Nora, she spent a long time in jail. She spent 3.5 years in jail before her trial began on February 9th, 2009.
Just sit there for 3 years, just wait for a trial.
Justice system is slow,
super
man.
Super slow. And there's a lot of interesting things about this trial. As mentioned, it was solely based on circumstantial evidence. The motive, according to prosecution, was so that she could collect her mother's money, just continue living her party lifestyle. She didn't want to be sent away to wherever her mother had allegedly threatened
boarding
to send
school,
her.
Military school.
Right. And the circumstantial evidence included a few things. One, the broken middle window pane that suggested someone knew about the hidden lock. Two, the 911 call where Nora said her mother had not been shot. They said, well, how would she know that? Three, all the fights that she had with her mother that were witnessed and overheard by, you know, family and friends. Four, that cut that was on the back of her left hand. Her trip to Walgreens at 4 o'clock in the morning. And finally, her inability to just explain where she was between 1 and 3 in the morning. And then there was that friend of hers, Andrew, who, you know, gave the statement that she wanted him to come to her house and go inside with her. All those things are basically what the prosecution...
That's what they built their case around.
Yeah, there was no physical evidence, no murder weapon,
No DNA.
Nothing like that that we're kind of used to seeing in modern cases. Right. This is not that old of a case.
No.
But that's kind of it.
The cut on her hand was made a really big deal of, and it's because Nora didn't help herself. Several different witnesses took the stand. I believe her aunt, multiple friends. Each one of them said that Nora told them a different story about how she hurt her hand. Oh, I burnt it cooking. My cat scratched me. just different stories. She told the police that she cut it while falling at the Italian festival on Friday night. And the police in the, one of the shows I was watching, they were like, how do you, because the cut was on the back of her hand. They're like, how do you fall on the back of your hand? Like, you fall on your palms to catch yourself. So they thought that was odd. She kept wearing long sleeve shirts. This is June in Memphis. It's very, very hot. She kept wearing long sleeve shirts and people were looking at her thinking, she's just trying to cover that cut up. She's conscious of her cut. And so they thought that was odd. This cut was just made a really big deal out of. It didn't help either that she was not forthcoming about this trip to Walgreens. The police found out about it because they found the Walgreens bag of first aid supplies in her car. They then went to the local Walgreens and they asked for the security footage. Got it. They saw her there 4 a.m. I watched the footage. She looks very calm. She asks the guy behind the counter for a paper towel to dab at her wound, which was bleeding. And the guy said that he remembered her because I guess that's a rare thing. Yeah. A pretty girl coming in at 4 a.m. asking for a paper towel. But why did she leave that out? You can look at it two ways. Did she leave it out because she's trying to cover up for herself? She doesn't want to admit she went to Walgreens. Or did she leave it out because she just is a kid and didn't think it was important?
Right.
We don't know.
And some people might say, well, if she killed her mother, she stabbed her mother 50 times, surely she would have cut herself.
Blood transfer somehow, yeah.
It cut herself in the process. But that's the crazy thing. There was no physical evidence to put her at the scene of the crime. There was none of her blood. In fact, there was DNA found from two unknown people on the pillow, in the sheets, and the bedpost. But none of it belonged to Nora. They were actually able to exclude her. So they have these two unknown DNA sources, but
Not Nora's,
and they're not, like, further investigated.
But apparently, like, you know how they have, like, you know more about it than I do, with GEDmatch and people's DNA and fingerprints and blood. I guess the blood that they did find, there was no record of it in any system that they had. So right. They weren't able to.
They didn't take it to the next.
They couldn't identify
steps
it.
Steps to, I mean, they could if they wanted to, at least these days. Figure out who it belongs to. But maybe if they ran through CODIS, you know.
Did they have that back in 2005?
Not the genetic genealogy.
Okay, so maybe they just didn't have what they needed back then.
Yeah, they just stuck it in the system.
They just looked for Nora, and that was it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't hers. What gets me is Jennifer had several blonde hairs grasped in her hand.
She was blonde herself.
Jennifer was blonde. So was it her own hair? I think it wasn't. I think they tested it for Jennifer and Nora. They tested it and they were able to exclude. It's not Nora. That was it. They didn't test it any further.
They have DNA and they have hair.
You'd think, though, if you're being stabbed and you're fighting for your life, it does seem logical that you would rip the hair out of the person that's attacking you, right? So to me, it would make more sense that it would be. She grabbed it out of whoever's stabbing her.
And I failed to mention that the DNA profiles that were found were female.
Right. Right? Yeah, that's weird.
But not Nora.
Why didn't they keep testing this stuff? Well, maybe they didn't have the
technology
to. I don't know. One person said that they thought that the crime scene was compromised. There was. Nora had a cat, and there's pictures of the crime scene, and there's a cat walking around. It admits all the blood and on the floor and everything. So one source says that perhaps the crime scene was compromised and they couldn't test the hair further. Another person said that, where does it say? That once they were able to rule out Nora, they didn't want to keep doing it because it wouldn't have helped their case any. Mm-hmm. So they didn't want to try looking any further. I don't know. I just think I would have loved to have known whose hair it was.
Had the evidence, it could be.
But we're never
tested now, but because of how what the story happening? Ends,
we're not going to know.
We will never know. You know, this case just continued to be handled strangely. Nora's defense team, or her attorney rather, Valerie Quarter, took on the case pro bono. She didn't charge Nora for anything. She thought that since there was no physical evidence, the prosecution would have a weak case.
She thought it was just a slam dunk.
Yeah. She didn't call any witnesses. She didn't ask or get Nora to testify. She focused on the lack of physical evidence, the fact that Nora, aside from that cut on her hand, didn't have any bruising or injuries. In fact, She had a perfectly intact manicure that she claims that surely would have been damaged if she had been involved in the stabbing of her mother.
Yeah, I saw the pictures of that. She had a fresh French manicure that she'd gotten like a day or two before the murder. And like, yeah, not one nail's chipped. Nothing.
I mean, I don't know how that would work.
Well, I mean, I think it's likely that...
If you're stabbing someone that
something, you're break out. A nail, because I don't know. I think it's likely. But yeah, no bruising, no wounds on her other than that cut.
Defense, yeah.
Right. The prosecution took the opposite approach. They called a ton of witnesses to testify against Nora's character. A parade of former friends and family members talk about her party lifestyle. Neighbors talk about overhearing fights between Nora and her mother. Nora didn't have a single family member to take her side. Mm. Which I do find interesting. They were all supporting the prosecution. I mean, I don't think they were super close, but still. Some people think that Jennifer's sisters did not like Nazmi, and that feeling went towards Nora. They thought she was sullen.
Oh, her
and
a dad?
Yeah, and they thought she was associated. Sullen and a party girl. And then other people think, oh, well, if Nora didn't get all of her mother's money, then would her sisters and her brother have gotten the money? Did they want the money? This is just different theories.
Money brings out the worst in people.
Yeah. Because, I mean, Jennifer was worth a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, near the end of the trial in 2009, the prosecution's big witness was Nora's friend, Andrew, the one that she'd been texting on and off that evening of the murder. He had testified that, you know, she tried to get him to come to her house early in the morning, which he thought was, you know, odd. The prosecution was trying to imply that Nora was trying to use him as an alibi so they could discover the body together. In the prosecution's closing argument, the prosecutor yelled at Nora. She said, "Just tell us where you were." And because she yells, this comes into play later. We'll make a note of that.
It's a big, it was a big no-no. The jury deliberated for 9 hours. They weren't convinced by the defense's arguments, and so she was convicted. But they did reject the argument that it was premeditated, and they opted for the lesser verdict of second-degree murder. She was sentenced for 20 years and 9 months in prison. I meant to tell you this earlier, because I read a book about this, and in the book that I read, the jurors all said, one of the jurors they interviewed was like, oh, we were all 100% convinced that she did it. Like, they all thought she did it. They just thought it was second degree. And what I thought was the most interesting
Which means it wasn't premeditated.
Right. What I thought was the most interesting that they said, this juror said, it wasn't what either side said that convinced us. What they said that was an aha moment for them that convinced them of her guilt was they were looking at that picture of Nora's hands where it was showing her manicure and the cut. And they said that they noticed a red mark on her hand. And they were like, why isn't anybody bringing that up? Why is anybody talking about this red mark on her hand? And this is when they're deliberating and everything. Well, they had two kitchen knives from the household, Jennifer's household, that was submitted as evidence. They weren't the murder weapon. They were just some sample knives that they had. They're like, well, let's just do an experiment. So the jurors, this jurors for this case, they acted out a stabbing. They took one of those knives that was in evidence. They wrapped the blade. And then one of the jurors stabbed something. I don't know what it was, pillow, something like that. But she was curious to see if the way she held the knife, if she could replicate the marks that she saw on Nora's hand. And after she did it, she had the exact same mark on her hand. Mm. And so all the jurors were like,
that's it.
Oh my gosh, like, she must have done it. So that was the convincing thing to them, was they acted out a murder while they were deliberating the case, and that was their aha moment that convinced them that she
from she something did that it. They came up with
that they came up own. On their own. Yes, exactly. That wasn't something that either attorney said. It was just something that they were like, "Oh, that must have been it." And I thought, "Wow, that's it's interesting to me to think about what the inside going on with a jury, how it is they make their decision, that it wasn't anything the attorney said. It was an experiment they tried on their own.
Interesting. And you know, she's sentenced to 20 years and 9 months, but that's not the end of the story.
No.
Shortly after she's convicted, things start heating up again. 5 days after she was found guilty, the defense was made aware of a previous statement made by her friend Andrew that completely contradicted what he had said at trial and gave an entirely different set of events that night. Apparently, the assistant prosecutor said he received a note in the middle of the trial, and he placed it in his notebook and allegedly forgot about it, forgot to give it to the defense attorney after the case, until after the case ended. So it's either, you know, super convenient that he did that or did it on purpose. Either way, this note basically said that Andrew admitted that he was high on ecstasy the night of the murder. Well, that's not great. I mean, it doesn't, you know, help his credibility or dependability.
How does he remember everything?
Right. So if the defense had known about this during the trial, it could have changed everything, because whether or not Nora was at home was the critical issue of the case. And he was the main one pretty much saying she was, and that she wanted him to come to her house. Mm-hmm. But if he was high and didn't remember things, that obviously changes a lot.
In this new statement, Andrew claimed that he was with someone who was in actuality out of state at the time. He's basically just another thing. Okay, sorry about that. We had a little bit of a technical error. The Supreme Court noted that Andrew himself could have been a suspect since he didn't have a real alibi, and there was, you know, crucial periods of time where they couldn't figure out where he was. But I don't think he did it. I don't know what in the world his motive would have been to have done anything to Jennifer. I do think he could have been looked at a little bit more closely because he was close to Nora.
Heavily involved
that evening with talking to her. Mm-hmm. He said they were friends with benefits. So, like, did he assist her in some way? I don't know. But they communicated so much that night. I don't even know if I should read all these. Phone records show Nora calling him at 12:55 a.m. Then at 3:54, he calls her at 4:36. Goes to call waiting. Nora calls him at 4:47, 5:01, 5:02, 5:03, 5:06.
Go to sleep.
They're texting back and forth. He texts her at 3:58. She texts him at 4:04. He texts her at 4:09. She texts him at 4:20, 4:59. This last text, as I said before, she just says answer. So it's like, I need to talk to you. So much.
They had a lot of interaction
back and
that
forth
night.
That night, which is odd.
Mm-hmm. I guess she could have been calling him because her mom was dead and she wanted support. But, you know, it's kind of odd that all these calls are, you know, and text messages right before or after she found her
right.
mom. So either she wanted support or help or.
Or she wanted his help if she, like, I need help. I need an alibi. I don't know. Aside from Andrew's statement, another issue with the trial that the defense brought up was what you mentioned earlier, the prosecutor yelling at Nora to tell them where she was during a closing argument. I didn't think anything of this. I didn't know that this was even something bad that she did, but apparently it's a big no-no. Prosecutors, they have a lot of leeway at trial, but apparently her yelling at Nora, it could have looked like she was implying that Nora was doing something wrong by refusing to testify, which you have a right not to testify. Mm-hmm. So the defense was arguing that by the prosecutor doing this, the prosecutor was implying to the juror that they should view Nora's silence as an admission of guilt.
Which I had never heard of that either. That's pretty interesting. So because of Andrew's statement that was withheld, the prosecutor's closing argument, the lack of physical evidence, and the fact that the Supreme Court had an issue with the state relying so heavily on the evidence of her
Her lifestyle.
They judged her lifestyle as opposed to the crime.
Right.
You know, because of her drug use and promiscuity, etc. That's what they built their case on. Because of all this, the Supreme Court unanimously overturned Nora's conviction on August 22nd, 2014.
So this is 9 years into her serving her sentence. She said that she found out while watching TV in her cell. Now, they could have gone and done a whole new trial. But because of the Supreme Court's ruling, they wouldn't have been allowed to use any of the evidence of Nora's hard partying at retrial, which, as you said, that was a big part of the first case, using all these witnesses to testify against her character. Their key witness, Andrew, his credibility has been shot because of his statement about being high, so they couldn't count on him. Of course, the lack of DNA evidence would have made things challenging. So the prosecution's thinking, what are we going to do? So they offer Nora our favorite thing, an Alfred plea. I think it's Alfred.
Alfred?
I think you said Alfred. Right. I love the Alfred plea. I want to do a whole podcast on people that take the Alfred plea.
We've done several of them.
It's so interesting because, as we've said before, the Alfred plea, it's a guilty plea. It's where you're acknowledging that the state has enough evidence against you, but you still get to walk free and claim your innocence to people. So that's what Nora did. And she thought at the time of signing that she could get out of prison right away. However, this new sentence was for 15 years, but she'd been in jail since 2005. So she still had some time left on the clock. She couldn't get out right away. But with good behavior, she was released a year later in 2016, having served just over a decade in prison. Since getting out, Nora, she settled the estate issue with her for her mother's estate with her family. I have no idea how much she got. I would love to know if any of them got anything. Something right, we should probably research left. Further. Yeah.
She also got involved with the Innocence Project.
Right.
They've
handled the West Memphis Three. They've handled a bunch of
a lot big, of high profile
cases where it's people that were
wrongfully convicted.
So it's interesting that she's working with them.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it seems like she still struggles with some of her lifestyle choices. In 2022, she was arrested in Kentucky at the Cracker Barrel.
Love Cracker Barrel. Mm,
I'm hungry.
It's like Poncho's cheese dip. Come on, Cracker Barrel. Spawn us. We love your biscuits. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so she was still having problems.
She was arrested because with drug possession. She had cocaine, marijuana, prescription medicines, and you know she admitted that they were hers. So she still, at least 2 years ago, was still struggling with those things. But you know, what do you think? What do you think about her guilt or innocence?
I am honestly 50-50. Like, I don't know. I struggle with the idea of her physically being able to do the murder because I do think her mom was taller than her and athletic. It's hard for me to imagine her having the strength to pull off.
She's, what, 17, 18?
Yeah. The physical strength to be able to pull it off is hard for me to wrap my mind around. But if she didn't do it, who in the world did? Because who else would have them? Jennifer seemed to be well-liked by people. I don't think it was connected to Nazmi. Nothing was stolen. Nothing was taken. So who else would have the motive or the reason to do it but Nora? So that makes me think, yeah, I could see that she did it. The thing with the jurors reasoning about the mark with the knife, I thought that was compelling. But I mean, it is all circumstantial. Yeah, that's what bothered. But all that makes me think it's Nora. But the fact that there's no DNA is troubling. I mean, I know DNA can be wrong, but you'd think there'd be some blood of hers somewhere. Where's the murder weapon? Where is the knife?
Yeah, I don't know if she directly did it.
Did
perhaps
she have help?
She was involved.
Did she hire somebody? I mean, how much? I don't think she would have hired anybody. I don't know. It's a fascinating case because I feel like I could see it either from either side.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, you know, like we mentioned earlier, we're never going to see any of that evidence that was discovered,
know.
That DNA, the hairs. They're not going to retest that because she took
that
Alfred
plea.
And so there's
they're
know,
not
going to
look into it
deal.
Anymore.
Yeah,
yeah.
So we may never know who actually killed her mother or her father.
Yeah.
But it's definitely an interesting case. I did look her up on Instagram. She is there, but she hasn't posted anything. She has zero posts. So she lives in the Nashville, Tennessee area. Okay. Speaking of Nashville, going to just transition to kind of wrapping things up. I'll be going to CrimeCon again this year. It's in Nashville, May 31st through June 2nd, and I will be at the GEDmatch DNA booth. So if anybody's there at CrimeCon, feel free to come by and say hello. I'm the bald guy with a new beard.
Yeah. Hopefully you'll have a new shirt with our,
logo.
For our podcast or something.
We are working on a new logo, a little revised update.
We love the chicken and the tea, but it doesn't super apply to our name.
Not anymore. So we got something new worked up there. Just by virtue of some of our other cases we've worked on in the past, still actively in touch with Nancy Little's family from the very first podcast.
We updated our Facebook and Instagram page about the letter writing campaign that was done.
Yeah, that letter writing campaign really finally paid off. You know, we sent all those letters and didn't know what happened. And the family spoke to six detectives a few weeks ago. And the detectives said there's a lot of pressure internally about this case. There's some interesting politics involved mm-hmm. with it, because apparently Nancy Little's autopsy report did not say the word homicide on it.
I think that's crazy.
And so it's like a loophole. They're right. kind of relying on, oh, well.
Oh, we don't have to look into it further because it's not technically ruled
so
as a homicide.
So they're trying to get that to be updated, mm-hmm. but they have to go get permission from the district attorney. Mm. And the DA's office gave a theory that Nancy died basically by accident.
Did they think she was going into labor and she mm-hmm. got herself in that strange position in the car?
Yeah.
I think that's
so
crazy.
The family's not really happy about hearing that. So we'll keep you posted as we learn yeah. more, but there at least is some discussion.
There's some movement.
There is some movement. The needle's moving a little bit.
So that was great. That means it was you guys, listeners, that wrote in.
Yes.
That
they said
made an impact.
The detectives told the family they got letters from all over the country. Yeah. They were from all different walks of life. So they were really, impressed, I guess, yeah. that people care, and the family really appreciates it.
I think
it,
that's
so.
Super exciting, and I'm appreciative of any help that
yes.
all of you listeners gave by doing that. It's made a difference. Even if it's a small one, it made a difference.
Yes, and then the Catherine Lowry case, which was the missing woman in Olive mm-hmm. Branch, Mississippi, who ended up being associated to Stephen DeLoge,
right.
who was associated to his half-sister's disappearance yeah. as well. We've been in contact still with actually Steven's family,
mm-hmm.
And they're asking us to help them with some things. So we'll keep you guys posted on that as we can.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we have a case from the 70s that we're working on, and it's got a lot of moving pieces, so it'll yeah. probably be a while before we can get that one out. But yeah. still actively...
We're working on them. They just take us a while. This one was
a labor of love for
it
you.
It was an overwhelming amount of information. So sometimes they take longer than normal to work yeah. up. But it is interesting. And I would love to hear some feedback from our showboats. I'm going to use
right.
our name.
Speaking of showboats,
give us
who's our shout outs this time?
Well, I have one. I have Karen W. Who do you have?
Karen from Lakeland, Tennessee. Okay. I got Naraj M. from West Palm Beach, Florida. Adrian F. from Olive Branch, Mississippi. Chris M. from Rochester, New York, and Josh B. from Dallas, Texas. Aww. We appreciate you guys.
We love you guys.
Your support.
Let us know your theories. Follow us on our social media, Facebook and Instagram. Let us know what you think happened to Jennifer, because
and
I would like to know.
That is Riverside Homicide.
Yeah, join us again next time for another podcast. Episode.
I was trying to think, what's the name of our star handle? Riverside Homicide
Podcast.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
We appreciate you guys listening, and until next time.
Sounds good. Bye.